This is edition number 1998 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 19th of December, 2025. Hello, you're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 18th of December, 2025. My name is John Hoyle, and my fellow readers are
Delia Malin,
Debs Hall,
and Dorry Brecken. On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 8 a.m. and will set at about 3:40 p.m. The winter solstice is on Sunday, the 21st of December, which means that finally our daylight hours will start to increase again. Early in November, we had the results for the Tesco Blue Token Scheme, and it was first place for the Mardler. Our request for funding had to be focused on a specific project, so we chose the support of a year's worth of new listeners. The cost of providing 24 players, together with the memory sticks and postal paraphernalia, comes to just under £1,500, which is what Tesco will now fund. There will be no more editions of The Mardler over the festive period, but a special New Year magazine section will be distributed on January the 2nd, and a normal service will resume on Friday the 9th of January.
The magazine supplement, suitably festively themed, will follow a little later in the programme and includes Clive's music listening suggestions, as well as an amusing investigation into the choice of gifts in the 12 Days of Christmas song. The relationship between the holly and the ivy also comes under scrutiny, and our taste buds are tempted by the residents of Ambridge. Intrigued? Keep listening.
But we begin with the main news items, which include urgent repairs needed on Cromer Pier, the latest on the Sheringham shelter shenanigans, a £2 million property taken into administration, a petition to improve safety on a pedestrian crossing after a fatality, and seasonal poultry sales in spite of avian flu. Let's start with those lead stories.
Cromer Pier has weathered countless storms and accommodates hundreds of thousands of visitors each year. But for the show to go on at the pier, urgent repairs are needed to secure its future. Engineers have discovered the Victorian landmark requires essential work following years of being battered by the North Sea. A recent survey showed some of the deck beams, trusses, bracing and columns require fixing to ensure the pier remains safe. North Norfolk District Council estimates it will cost at least £250,000 to repair the high-priority issues, but more money could be needed for less urgent works in the future. Engineers could begin tackling the structural defects by next month. If the work is approved, officials hope to begin the repairs as soon as possible to capitalise on the quiet period in January and February, with no shows planned at the theatre and lower footfall expected during the winter months. Cromer Pier was built in 1901, but there has been an earlier wooden structure at the location since the 1800s, which were washed away by storms. North Norfolk District Council owns the Grade 2 listed pier and has a duty to maintain it. Officers said the pier is set in an extremely harsh environment and needs frequent monitoring to ensure it's kept safe through regular maintenance. The £250,000 repairs follow a huge amount of investment in the Victorian landmark in recent years. In March, council officials celebrated the opening of the backstage area at the Pavilion Theatre following a major revamp. It's part of a wider £2 million scheme to bring the pier up to date and secure its future as one of the main tourist attractions along the North Norfolk coast. Councillors will meet on Wednesday to decide whether or not to support the £250,000 funding for the repairs. And a photo here shows a large section of the pier broken and fallen into the sea, separating the rest of the structure from the promenade. This was after storm damage in 1993.
Traditional Christmas poultry sales will return this week to auction turkeys, geese, chickens and ducks from East Anglian farms, despite the shadow cast by bird flu outbreaks. The devastating avian influenza virus has taken a heartbreaking toll on the region's poultry farms, with thousands of turkeys culled in the run-up to Christmas. Although national retailers are not expecting shortages, Norfolk's annual poultry auctions are expected to be smaller this year. But organisers said they remain a great opportunity for people to bid for a quality farm-fresh bird for their festive dinner table. Our Christmas poultry sale is a wonderful tradition which brings together local producers and consumers, said Key's director Tim Blythe, the grandson of founder Geoffrey Key. 2025 has been a difficult year for poultry producers in Norfolk, with the continuing shadow of avian flu over the industry. We expect this year's sale to be smaller than in previous years, but nevertheless we are delighted to be carrying on the tradition for the 73rd year. As ever, we expect our Christmas poultry sale to be a busy, sociable and festive occasion. The sale usually attracts hundreds of people, mostly private individuals seeking to buy the main attraction for their Christmas lunch. The majority of the birds, which include Norfolk black and bronze turkeys, and free-range geese and ducks, have been raised by small-scale local farmers. Office manager Anita Padfield said, "It has been a very worrying time for farmers because of avian flu in the county. The entry for the Norwich Livestock Market poultry sale is down by about a third, but customers can be assured the poultry here for sale will be top quality."
The charity behind a Norfolk Hall visited by thousands of school children over the years has entered into administration after falling into financial difficulties. Whitwell Hall Country Centre has used the 40-acre site based near Reefham to provide children with residential outdoor experiences for the last 87 years since 1938. Centre manager John McKean said the charity was £40,000 in debt before the appointment of administrators and that staff have been badly let down by trustees. He said three of the charity's four staff were recently made redundant and their wages had not been paid since August. The charity's trustees said the funds from bookings were no longer covering the cost of its overheads, including wages and insurance. "It's been my life and place of work and home for 29 years. And Mr. McKean, who is still employed by the charity and stays on site to look after the building. I was married here. I've brought up my two children here. It's been my home. Norfolk's been my home." He said the hall and its grounds are worth in the region of £2 million. Alongside hosting schools, the charity organises community transport for people living in the Reefham area, as well as social activities for the elderly and vulnerable people. Mr. McKean said that schools have booked to visit Whitwell Hall in 2026 had all paid deposits, so they will not be financially impacted by its closure. In a statement, the charity's trustees said there were no funds to renew the company's insurance, which would have potentially put lives at risk. "We are of the opinion that the COVID lockdown, the recent economic climate and the increasing pressures on school staff and the curriculum have been the major contributory factor in fewer bookings and bear no reflection on the hard-working and committed staff at Whitwell," the statement added.
A woman is launching a petition after a boy was hit by a bus near a dangerous pedestrian crossing. The incident happened in Stalham in October when a child was struck by the vehicle close to the pedestrian crossing on Ingham Road. The busy crossing sits on the route between Stalham High School and the Bachelor Loke housing estate. Earlier this year, following concerns about visibility for both motorists and pedestrians approaching the crossing, a hedge along the road was trimmed back. But Emily Howe, who lives near the road, thinks more should be done. She said, "I don't want anyone else to get hurt, but the pedestrian crossing there is very dangerous." She said that cars frequently either do not stop or stop very late at the crossing. "We need a ramp or a raised crossing to slow traffic down before they get close to it," she said. Her campaign, once launched, will receive the support of Councillor Matthew Taylor, who represents Stalham on North Norfolk District Council. He said, "The Ingham Road crossing is a major concern for Stalham residents. It links a large housing estate with essential services like the high school and doctor's surgeries, yet visibility has long been an issue." Mr. Taylor said he worked to have the hedges cut back to waist height to improve sight lines, and this will now be maintained, but insisted more must be done. "A raised crossing is the next logical step, and I would fully support a petition to Norfolk County Council to deliver it," he said. Ms. Howe appreciated that the hedges had been trimmed back, but said the road was still not safe. "We had one person who has been hit. How many more do we need?" she said. After the collision in October, the boy suffered minor injuries and was discharged from hospital on the same day.
A bus stop will remain suspended from use pending a review after protesters won their fight to save it from being bulldozed. The shelter at Ottendorf Green in Station Approach, Sheringham, has been out of action for buses for more than 10 days, resulting in users redirected to a bus stop outside Tesco. It was closed following a community protest to stop Norfolk County Council demolishing the 1950s shelter, which demonstrators described as a part of the town's heritage. However, as Sheringham Town Council voted to not support its demolition, the County Council ceased work on the project and withdrew from the site, leaving questions as to whether the bus stop would reopen. But now, the Town Council has issued a statement that said it will not be operating as a bus stop until the situation had been reviewed. The statement read, "In terms of the bus services, Norfolk County Council and Sanders have confirmed that the Wells and Holt-bound buses will continue to stop at the bus stop opposite Tesco whilst the overall situation is reviewed. Therefore, Ottendorf Green is not currently operating as a bus stop. We will now need to consider how we take this site forward. There is unlikely to be any update until after the Christmas period." The removal of the bus shelter was part of plans to create a new travel hub, with the whole scheme now being scrapped. It has left the County Council scrambling to make use of the £580,000 set aside for the scheme, with the government set to claw it back if it's not been spent by the end of March. Council leaders have suggested they could use the money elsewhere in the county. County Hall officials said it was too early to say how it might be used or where, but they've also not ruled out developing an alternative scheme for Sheringham. They said what happens next was dependent on a review of future arrangements for bus services in the location. Council officers said the safety issues which had prompted the proposed revamp remained an issue and needed to be resolved. A spokesman said, "A key element of the proposed scheme was to widen the footpath outside the existing bus shelter, which is currently one of the main pinch points in the area. Without the ability to create this essential additional space, the scheme cannot go ahead as planned. The wider footway was necessary to reduce congestion between waiting bus passengers and pedestrians moving along this busy section of pavement. Because this pedestrianisation safety concern will now remain, we will need to review future arrangements for bus services at this location in order to solve the issue." The County Council also stressed it will not be asking the Town Council to cover the costs of the work, which has been carried out at the Sheringham site. Before the decision by the town council, which owns the land the bus shelter is on, to block the demolition, Graham Plant, County Hall's Cabinet Member for Highways, Transport and Infrastructure, has said he was prepared to use the money elsewhere. At a council meeting last week, he said, "I have a time limit on the money to be spent, and if that money cannot be spent in that place by March the 26th, I'll find somewhere where it can. I'm not intending to lose that money. If I don't spend it in Sheringham, I'll spend it somewhere else. So I have several schemes across Norfolk that I can spend this money on." Sir Keir Starmer said he was not surprised by the strength of feeling in Sheringham over Norfolk County Council's plans to demolish the 1950s structure. The Labour leader lent his support to the campaigners during his visit to Norwich's first bus depot to announce a £46 million investment in the county's bus services. He said, "Norfolk County Council should listen and respond to local people, who obviously have strong views on this, and I'm not surprised." Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander also called for Norfolk County Council to work with local people to find a solution that will allow the shelter to remain while the wider transport improvements could continue. She said, "I think the people of Sheringham have made their views known about the bus shelter. Norfolk County Council have got the money to get on with the job. The government have given them the money through bus funding. They need to amend the scheme and make sure we make these improvements that people want. But the people also want to keep their bus shelter, so Norfolk County Council should pull their finger out and get on with the job."
An eroding cliff has been stabilised after a cliff slide uncovered Japanese knotweed. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, was forced to close the promenade at Overstrand after a cliff slide in March. The slip was found to contain a fast-growing and invasive plant species called Japanese knotweed. A contractor was brought in to remove the knotweed, and the work was carried out over an 8-week period. NNDC has now confirmed the work has been completed. The cliff has also been stabilised using interlocking concrete blocks which look like giant Lego bricks and will act as toe weighting for the cliff. New drainage points were also installed behind the blocks to prevent groundwater problems. The promenade remains closed to the public while the situation is monitored. It had been estimated that the removal works could cost up to £120,000, but NNDC's website says the exact cost of the operation is still unknown.
A new 7-day hourly rail service is starting at West Runton Station. The Bittern Line Community Rail Partnership, CRP, successfully campaigned to end the uneven service pattern, with the new service starting on Sunday, December the 14th. Previously, weekday and Saturday services ran hourly, but the busy Sunday service only called every 2 hours. David Pearce, chair of the Bittern Line Community Rail Partnership, said the Bittern Line Community Rail Partnership have been campaigning for over 4 years to see an end to the anomaly which saw Sunday trains at West Runton only calling every 2 hours when the pattern was hourly for the rest of the week. "We very much welcome that Greater Anglia have agreed to make this substantial improvement, which will see some 13 trains in each direction now calling at the station on Sundays, providing a major boost to connectivity and both the local and visitor economy." The Bittern Line CRP celebrated this achievement at West Runton Station on Sunday between 10 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. with refreshments, festive treats and free Bittern Line guides.
Millions of pounds of extra money has been made available to help maintain Norfolk's roads, including to fix potholes. Norfolk County Council has received confirmation from the government for highways maintenance. The Labour government has confirmed the rise from £56 million in 2025-26 to more than £83 million by 2029-30 and a £27 million increase over that period. The council will be able to use that money to tackle potholes and surfacing work to stop new ones appearing. Leaders at Conservative-run County Hall welcome the confirmation of how much Norfolk will get following the £7.3 billion for local roads announced by Chancellor Rachel Reeves in her budget. For the first time in a number of years, the government has announced multi-year settlements for road maintenance. Council officials said that will better help with planning. Although, with all of Norfolk's councils due to be scrapped and replaced under local government reorganisation, there remains uncertainty over which authorities will be responsible for which parts of the county. The government also announced bus grant allocations through to 2029-2030. Which means there will be more than £15 million to spend on bus service and infrastructure each year. Graham Plant, the Council's Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said, "This is fantastic news for Norfolk. Securing multi-year funding for both highways maintenance and bus services gives us the certainty we need to plan ahead and deliver improvements that will make a real difference for residents and businesses. These settlements allow us to join up funding streams, deliver safer and more reliable transport, and ensure Norfolk is fit for the future." Norwich North Labour MP Alice MacDonald said, "Labour promised to fix an extra million potholes a year, and this record funding shows we're serious about delivering it." Edmund King, AA President, said, "Potholes are the number one transport concern for drivers and continue to blight too many roads, so this funding should help smooth out the road ahead." Norfolk County Council maintains most of the 6,000 miles of roads in Norfolk. However, the A47 and A11 are the responsibility of National Highways.
A Norfolk fruit grower has pledged to continue supporting a community food charity next year after hitting a £3,000 fundraising milestone in 2025. Place UK, based in Tunstead near Wroxham, is one of the UK's leading fruit growers and has supported Norwich-based The Feed since the start of 2024. As a friend of The Feed, the firm pledges to raise at least £1,000 per year, the monthly cost of supplying free fresh fruit and vegetables to members of The Feed's social supermarket. By offering discounted food and everyday essentials, The Feed aims to reduce the estimated 6.7% of Norfolk residents who are coping with malnutrition, a third higher than the national average. As well as fundraising events, donations and sponsorship, Place UK has also donated excess stock, including frozen beans and pulses, for The Feed's cooking lessons, helping the charity's members to learn how to make budget-friendly, nutritious meals. Melissa Clements, Business Development and Marketing Manager at Place UK, said, "We're incredibly proud to be supplying our products to retailers, wholesalers, food manufacturers and restaurants across the UK. But we're equally proud and focused on doing our part to help alleviate food poverty in the county we call home. The Feed offers an amazing and vital service, providing access to affordable groceries so everyone has the chance to eat well." Siobhan Eek, fundraising and Macomb's lead at The Feed, added, "We absolutely love working with Place UK. Their long-term support makes a real and invaluable difference to The Feed, our community and members. They support us in so many ways, and by raising funds, enable us to provide top quality, free, fresh fruit and veg to our community. They also donate top quality produce our members love cooking with, and their donations provide our members with everything from pasta to special treats and toiletries. All the things many of us take for granted, but make a meaningful difference to our community on so many levels.
Outgoing Royal Cromer Ladies Captain Jane Gurney Reid presented a cheque for £2,120.95 to the Big C's CEO, Karen Vincent. During the year, the Ladies of Royal Cromer have been raising money for the cancer charity. At the presentation, Karen updated the ladies about the ongoing work of the charity. In addition, incoming Ladies Captain Anita Booth has also chosen the Big C as her charity for next year.
A festive event has helped strengthen community ties while raising funds for education. Horning Primary School hosted a Christmas cafe at Horning Village Hall, welcoming families and residents for an afternoon of cakes, conversation and seasonal cheer. Pupils dressed in aprons served food and drinks, managed tables and created a warm atmosphere with seasonal music in the background. Jan Bellison, head teacher at Horning Primary, said, "Opening the doors at 1:30 p.m. to a queue of people waiting to come in was an indication that it was going to be a successful event. The school is a much valued part of the local community. We are always exceptionally well supported by our pupils, families and friends and many local residents. However, our cafe events create an opportunity for wider community involvement, and we all really appreciated the fantastic support we received for the Christmas cafe. The event raised £765 for school projects. The Christmas cafe is part of the school's ongoing community engagement. Pupils and staff have recently participated in Horning's Harvest Festival and an Armistice Day service of remembrance."
You are listening to edition number 1998 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 19th of December 2025. Still to come, there are items about a new TV show filmed in Norfolk, encouragement to use an invisible postbox for Christmas cards, and some plans to develop local businesses. But before all that, letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Hugh Martin of Bernard Road, Cromer, writes that a shelter designer is a forgotten man. Now that the Sheringham bus shelter has been saved for posterity, you might like to revisit an item in the North Norfolk News of the 19th of November, 1954. Mr. Pegg said he was against building the shelter, and he knew several people in the town who were anxious to protest against its erection. Yes, the people of Sheringham were rejecting again, this time because they didn't want the shelter built in the first place. But it went ahead, and its completion, and cost £200, was recorded in the EDP of the 19th of May 1955. The designer was Mr. R.H. Searshall, surveyor to Sheringham UDC. Mr. Searshall is something of a forgotten figure in Sheringham's history, but he was in post for around 20 years in the 1950s and 1960s, during which time Sheringham built its first council houses in Pine Grove and later in Woodland Rise. He seems to have been instrumental in these projects, along with the architect W.F. Tuthill. His other projects for the town included the RNLI kiosk on the West Beach, in a similar style to the bus shelter, and possibly also the town's unique benches with precast concrete ends. These used to be commonplace throughout the town, but have now largely disappeared, although I remember coming across an example a few years ago on Franklin Hill. He lived in a handsome pebble-dashed house in Common Lane, probably one of several designed here by Mr. Tuthill.
Georgina Ragg of Drabblegate in Aylsham writes, "What the Sheringham protesters have overlooked is that their beloved bus shelter is not actually complete. It originally had metal-framed windows and built-in seats. These were removed some years ago, presumably to save maintenance costs, and what remains is just a brick shell. I don't remember anyone protesting about that."
And now to this week's obituaries.
a retired High Court judge, Norfolk landowner, and namesake of James Bond's nemesis, Sir John Blofeld, has died at the age of 93. Sir John was a notable figure in his own right, but was also known for being the elder brother of cricket commentator Henry Blofeld and the father of author Tom Blofeld. Born on July the 11th, 1932, John Christopher Calthorpe Blofeld was the second of three children of Tom and Grizel Blofeld. He grew up in Hoveton on the family's estate near Wroxham, which the Blofelds had owned since the 17th century. Not to be confused with the 19th century Hoveton Hall, Hoveton House was built by Sir John's ancestor, Thomas Blofeld, in 1680 and was long regarded as one of Norfolk's architectural jewels. Sir John's name would become the inspiration for the Bond supervillain, Ernst Stavro Blofeld, though he always treated the supposed connection with amusement. When contacted in 2015 by the Mail on Sunday about the Bond link, he said, "Whether I was at school with a boy called Fleming, or whether I was nasty to a boy called Fleming, I have absolutely no idea." Educated at Eton and King's College, Cambridge, he was called to the bar in 1956. In 1966, he successfully prosecuted a 17-year-old labourer under the Race Relations Act for sticking a pamphlet saying, "Blacks not wanted here," on the front door of the Labour MP for Southall, reportedly the first case of its kind. He took silk in 1975 and became a recorder of the Crown Court the same year. In 1988, at Norwich Crown Court, Sir John jailed a clairvoyant for a sustained course of conduct of obtaining money by deception, after the man extracted a wife's life savings by claiming that his supernatural powers could force her unfaithful husband to abandon his mistress. Beyond the courts, Sir John gave many years of service to the Church of England, acting as Chancellor of the Diocese of St Edmundsbury and Ipswich from 1973 to 2009, and of Norwich from 1998 to 2007. He was appointed a Deputy Lieutenant of Norfolk in 1991. Sir John married Judith Ann Mitchell, born 1932, in 1961, and together they lived at Hoveton House. She died in 2013 and her funeral took place at Wroxham Church, followed by a family interment at Hoveton St John Church. Sir John died at home on Sunday, November the 30th, surrounded by his family after a short illness. He is survived by daughter Charlotte, sons Tom and Piers, and five grandchildren. His funeral will take place at Norwich Cathedral on Friday, January 23rd at 2 p.m.
Muriel Cranston died at Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital on December the 4th, aged 94. Wife of the late Roy, mum to Linda and mother-in-law to Stan, much loved granny to her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The funeral at Cromer Crematorium is on Monday, December the 22nd at 11 a.m. Family flowers only, but donations for EAAA can be sent care of Blythe & Sons Funeral Directors, 4 Cremer Street, Sheringham, NR26 8DZ, or telephone number 01263 823 155, or email northnorfolkfuneralservices.co.uk.
Derek Lewis of Sheringham died peacefully on December the 6th, aged 90. A much-loved husband to Rita, he will be sadly missed by all who knew him. Funeral at 2 p.m. on January the 9th at Holy Trinity Church, West Runton. Family flowers only, but donations welcome, to be shared between Blind Veterans UK and Children with Cancer UK. Cheques payable to NNFS Donations Account, care of Blythe & Sons Funeral Directors, 4 Cremer Street, Sheringham, NR26 8DZ, or phone 01263 823 155, or online at northnorfolkfuneralservices.co.uk.
And now some articles to encourage and entice your attendance at local events and establishments.
The Clye Advent Windows Trail returns this December, transforming the coastal village into a glowing calendar of illuminated displays. Locals unveil new decorated windows each evening between 4pm and 8pm, with the display growing daily until around 38 windows are lit up by Christmas Eve. Simon Reid, chairman of Clye Harbour, said, "Clye Advent Windows is a very special way to spread some Christmas cheer, and we are so grateful to our friends and supporters in the village who have come together to create their windows. It wouldn't happen without them." The windows will remain illuminated each evening until January the 1st. Maps for the trail are available from village shops and pubs or online at clyeharbour.co.uk.
Sheringham Little Theatre's rendition of The Wizard of Oz will see Dorothy and her dog Toto embark on their iconic journey from the seaside town. To match the coastal setting, Dorothy's famous trio of companions have been given local twists, assuming the roles of a fast food worker, Morris dancer, lifeboatman, and steam train driver. Nick Earnshaw, writer, director, and the actor playing the lion, said, "We wanted to give the show a really local flavour as it heads off to the Land of Oz. There's some great Sheringham scenery references, along with modern twists, plus music ranging from current songs to 80s power ballads. It's lots of fun for all the family and for the kids. We've got Minecraft, K-pop Demon Hunters, and the 6-7 Crazies, thanks to my 11-year-old son Archie, who is my unofficial script advisor. Characters in the play will undergo an uplifting journey of self-discovery, harking back to the original's themes. Mr. Earnshaw, who last played the Lion 25 years ago, is joined in the six-strong professional cast by Megan Bryce as Dorothy, Aylsham local Charlie Randall as Scarecrow, and Birmingham's Stephen Rostance as Tin Man. Oliver Westlake will play Glinda, the Good Witch, and Alexander Parks will take on the role of the Wicked Witch of the West. The production will also feature local youngsters as the Munchkins. Behind the scenes, North Walsham's musical duo Ron Sayer and Charlotte Joyce will lend their expertise as musical director and vocal coach, respectively, with Tom Withington as choreographer. The show runs to January the 4th. Tickets can be purchased at the theatre's website or by calling the box office on 01263 822 347.
Picnic Box launched in Vicarage Street, North Walsham, on Friday morning. Customers will be able to come in and get comfortable while tucking into sandwiches, sausage rolls and homemade cakes, all of which will be completely gluten-free. Owner and founder Helen Taylor is gluten intolerant herself and said she has to be very careful when she's eating out. A lot of the time when you go somewhere and tell them you are gluten-free, they'll say, "You can have chips," she said. "Some places have even offered me a banana, which is just silly." Miss Taylor runs a catering unit at Beeston Regis Holiday Park and said she's lots of calls for gluten-free items, which inspired her to go all in. She's always dreamed of opening a cafe, so she put a lot of care into designing the space. "I wanted something that looked a bit bougie. I love antiques, so I have them everywhere, and we have some lovely vintage crockery. There's also a 1950s inspired area." Miss Taylor added she's especially happy to have opened in North Walsham. "I'm an Aylsham girl originally, but I've lived in Meeting Hill, about a mile from North Walsham, for 11 years, she explained. "North Walsham is our nearest town, and I love popping in. I love looking at all the old, quirky, listed buildings."
The team behind the Thursford Christmas Spectacular has started taking bookings for 2026 for its 49th production. The three-hour extravaganza will be filled with singing, dancing, music, comedy and much, much more, with an all-star cast of 120 performers across a 130-foot stage. George Cushing, associate producer, said, "This year has been our most magical yet, with cast, crew, critics and customers' expectations being blown away." The show will run from November the 10th to December the 23rd, 2026, in a slight change from previous years. There are still tickets available for the remaining 2025 shows, which finish on December the 23rd. Those heading to the site will be able to watch duo Leo Lay, who perform a routine in one wheel, Centripetal Forces with a skipping rope act, and returning comedian Lloyd Hollett. Tickets are available to book online for 2025 and 2026 now, with group deposits available online from January the 8th at 10 a.m.
For many, a Boxing Day or New Year's dip is an annual tradition, and there are plenty of beaches to choose from in Norfolk. Seven of North Norfolk's beaches have recently been rated as excellent in their bathing quality by the Environment Agency, making them great spots for a winter swim this year. Here is a roundup of the top spots in Norfolk. Wells Next the Sea. Located just on the North Norfolk coast, the town is known for its working harbour, a large sandy beach and a quaint town centre with plenty of shops and cafes, perfect for a pit stop after your dip. Its shallow waters are great for a refreshing plunge, but visitors should be mindful of strong currents during tide changes. Cromer. This North Norfolk beach is a famous spot for a winter dip, with its annual events like the Cromer Boxing Day Dip, where people go for a fun run and a dip in the sea during the morning. The event is usually organised by the North Norfolk Beach Runners, and it often benefits a local charity. The annual event attracts thousands and many attendees dressed in festive attire. Sea Polling. This North Norfolk beach is another popular spot for a winter dip, especially on Boxing Day. Each year, the Boxing Day dip takes place at midday, perfect for curing Christmas Day hangovers. Let's Do It Anyway organises the fundraising events, which is a Norfolk-based charitable trust that promotes equality and inclusion. Sheringham. Sheringham Beach is located just 5 miles from Cromer and is nestled in a busy town with plenty of shops and restaurants. Each year, people start their year with a splash and take part in Sheringham's New Year's Day Dip, which features a fancy dress competition. It's organised by the Sheringham and Cromer Round Table, and 400 brave souls took part in the last event. The dip usually starts during late morning at the East Promenade and it raises money for local causes. Munsley. The seals aren't the only thing attracting people to this particular stretch of the coast. Each year, participants enter the sea on Boxing Day for their chilly swim to raise money. The coastal village also has a blue flag sandy beach and is decorated with colourful beach huts. Shallow rock pools located on the beach are ideal for children, and the beach offers year-round sea fishing, making it perfect for summer and winter. And now it's time for our festive magazine supplement.
A Christmas Song reimagined by a birder, written for the Mardler by Nick Marshall and commissioned and edited by Trudy Box. The well-known 12 Days of Christmas song was published in the late 18th century and became an established feature of the Victorian fantasy version of Christmas. This article is an explanation of each of the 12 days, part fact and part the imagination of a lawyer and lifelong ornithologist. In a similar vein to the absurdist nature of the original text, it takes the premise that although only half of the true love's gifts over the 12 days of Christmas are explicitly of birds, in fact, they all are, the other half being avian allegories, This allegation might not hold up in court, but is definitely in the Christmas birding spirit. A partridge in a pear tree. As a lawyer, I do have some difficulty understanding exactly what the gift consists of. Certainly it involves a partridge, but is the tree included as well, or do the words in a pear tree merely allude to the location of the bird? Clearly it's not well drafted, but applying normal rules of legal construction, it's noted that none of the other 11 gifts contain any such descriptive words, and this indicates that the gift is of both of the bird and the tree. As an ornithologist, I have another problem. Namely, what in the devil's briefcase is a partridge doing in a tree? All species of partridge live exclusively on the ground. They're physically unable to perch in a tree. Fields are their usual habitat in Britain, but then I have to concede that a partridge in a field doesn't really cut it. 2. Turtle doves. A very special present. Special because this species, formerly so much part of our countryside, has declined catastrophically in Britain by some 97% over the last 40 years. As with yesterday's partridge, however, there is a slight, well, ornithological problem with this gift turning up on Boxing Day, namely that in the Christmas season, the nearest turtle doves are thousands of miles away somewhere south of the Sahara. They are only summer visitors to Britain, so this is another clash of poetic license and the dead hand of fact. All a bit of a challenge. 3 French hens, said to represent gold, frankincense and myrrh. These 3 varieties of French hens are at the high end of the gastronomic table of poultry in France. This is perhaps the most practical of the 12 gifts, though it has to be said that the competition is not strong. Domesticated hens and chickens mostly derive from the Asiatic species red jungle fowl, which I have seen in the foothills of the Himalayas. Despite millennia of domestication and selective breeding, I was struck by how close they are in appearance to many farmyard chickens. 4. Calling birds. Birdsong is principally for attracting a mate and establishing a breeding territory. Birds don't breed in midwinter, so there's little birdsong to be heard in the countryside then. Birds do, however, call all year round, including in the Christmas period. Bird calls are simpler than bird song. Often just a single note of a certain pitch and timbre, which identifies the species. So, which are the calling birds presented by the true love at Christmas? Prime suspects might be a winter visitor called redwing. The call, an elongated, penetrating seep. The great spotted woodpecker, a loud, explosive chack. The robin, obviously. The mistle thrush, also obviously. It loves to eat mistletoe berries, and the call is a distinctive rattle. 5 gold rings. Recent winters have seen quite a rise in the numbers of wintering lesser white-fronted geese in Norfolk. I saw a group of 11 which spent the Christmas period in 2023 by the River Stookey, but they are still a very rare bird and definitely not for the Christmas table. Similar in appearance to the common greater white-fronted goose, a distinguishing feature of the lessers is the golden ring around their eye. These are the gold rings of the song. It's just a pity that one of the 3 birds gifted by the true love had only 1 eye. Incidentally, a goose which is suitable for the Christmas table is the Canada goose, of which there are thousands roaming the Norfolk countryside. All feral birds, which don't belong in Britain and which should be culled. They can be tough, and the traditional Norfolk recipe is to slowly roast the bird with a thoroughly soaked soft red brick for hydration. After 3 hours, throw the bird away and eat the brick. It will be more tender. 6. Geese are laying. No self-respecting wild goose in the northern hemisphere will be laying eggs at Christmas time. So this gift takes us south of the equator in the austral summer. Obviously, the song refers here to Christmas Island goose, also known as the Cape Barren goose, a grey, rather thick-set creature said to be highly aggressive. It's an Australian species, just saying. 7 swans are swimming. Yes, but which species of swan? Not, I think, the familiar domesticated mute swans, which loaf listlessly around city parks and boating lakes all year, but their far nobler wild relatives, which migrate here for the winter from breeding grounds in Iceland and the Arctic tundra of northern Russia. These are Buick swans and Hooper swans, which congregate in their thousands in places such as the Ouse Washes in Cambridgeshire, a truly elemental sight, their haunting calls the very essence of the North. 8 maids are milking. When I started to think of a link to a bird, I thought of cattle egrets, white heron-like birds, slightly larger than a wood pigeon and in the habit of consorting with cattle. No, I thought, too ridiculous. So I resorted to something called AI, and the first thing to come up was cattle egrets. I had thought that what passes for my intelligence was not great but kind of okay. It's a tad upsetting to find it's actually artificial. But the uncomfortable thought of them milking cows, those sharp bills. Let's move on to day 9. 9 ladies dancing. I believe this refers to long-tailed tits, the fairies of the hedgerows, a tiny bird with a body even smaller than a blue tit and a ludicrously outsized tail. In winter, they likely dance through the air in groups, typically of 9 or so, like wind-blown seed heads. Northern race birds, Scandinavia, Siberia, etc., not Yorkshire, have gorgeous snowy white heads. 10 lords are leaping. The bird to have provoked their lordships to leap is the ivory-billed woodpecker, sadly now believed extinct. It was known colloquially as the Lord God bird. So beautiful and striking it was that on sighting a specimen, 18th century birders were wont to exclaim, "Lord God, what a bird!" There's an apocryphal story that sometime in the 1790s, a group of 10 members of the House of Lords Ornithological Society mounted an expedition to Cuba to search for the bird. And upon finding one, they all leapt spontaneously in the air, stridently intoning the time-honoured oath and achieving immortality by securing their place in the song. 11 pipers piping. Oyster catchers. Several birds produce calls which may be described as piping, but none more obviously so than the oyster catcher, or to give it its country name, sea pie. Pie, clearly a contraction of piper. Like bagpipers, they often pipe very loudly in close-knit groups, producing an evocative, far-carrying sound, glorious to some, but less so to others, and so redolent of the highlands and the coastal marshes of East Anglia, in the case of oyster catchers. 12 drummers drumming. These are woodpeckers, well known for their drumming sound made when they hammer on trees. We have 3 species in Britain, each producing a different sound when drumming. So it's reasonable to suppose that the gift comprised 2 pairs of each. All 3 species have a striking appearance, either contrasting patterns of jet black and pure white, or green and yellow. However, the relevant feature here is that all show patches of bright red on their heads, and I've seen no scientific paper or peer-reviewed studies disproving the obvious conclusion that the red has evolved in response to the increasing prevalence of the Father Christmas hats worn at this time of year by so many sartorially challenged people. So, there we are. If you have been, thanks for listening, and have a peaceful and happy Christmas.
Clive McCombie writes on My Music for You for December. This monthly broadcast arrives a week early because the last Friday this year falls on Boxing Day, and the Mardler volunteers are generously allowed to observe the bank holiday. That means that my musical choices this month need to reflect the week before Christmas and also some winter warmers as we anticipate January and the new year. For a change, this time I thought I might stray from a more classical repertoire and instead make selections from seasonal musicals and the Great American Songbook. What a plethora of choices. To start our journey, I'm going to take us back 80 years to December 1945, when, not long after the end of World War II, the prospect of a peaceful Christmas must have gladdened everyone's heart, even if the privations of rationing restricted what was available and or could be afforded. A new song that year seemed to capture the atmosphere of an old-fashioned Christmas, and it was The Christmas Song, or Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. It was published in 1945, though not first recorded until 1946, and its composers were Mel Torme and Robert Wells. According to Torme, it was actually written in July 1945, during an exceptionally hot summer, and in an effort to, quote, stay cool by thinking cool, lyricist Wells thought that if he could immerse himself in winter, he could cool off. Hence references not only to chestnuts, but also to Jack Frost, Eskimos and Yuletide carols. It has become the most popular of all Christmas songs. Another song written under the shadow of World War II was I'll Be Home for Christmas. It was written to honour American soldiers longing to be home for the holidays. It is written from the viewpoint of a soldier stationed overseas during the war. In a message home to his family, he asks them to prepare the holiday for him with snow, mistletoe and presents on the tree. It ends on a melancholy note with him saying, I'll be home for Christmas, but only in my dreams. This was 1943, and it would be another 2 years before that dream came true for some, but by no means all. It seems appropriate that at this time we look back on this 80th anniversary year and try and imagine what Christmas 1945 must have meant, not only to those that survived, but also to those that lost family and friends. Moving on now to a song that appears in the 1957 film, An Affair to Remember. It's called Our Love Affair, and the melody features at various points in the film, but particularly at the end, when the characters, played by Cary Grant and Deborah Carr, meet up again, this time for keeps on Christmas Eve. The film was a remake of an original film made at the beginning of World War II. The song did not feature in that film, but the younger film was almost identical to the original one on the scene-by-scene basis. The song is a very simple one with a pretty and definitely hummable melody, which can rapidly become an earworm, so be warned. Finally, let's move on from Christmas to January and look forward to warmer weather with the 1934 song June in January from a now forgotten film, Here Is My Heart, starring Bing Crosby. It is a song that has been covered by many popular singers, including Julie London and Dean Martin. But for me, the Crosby version is the best, and it is available on YouTube. That brings us to the end of My Music for You in 2025. This has not been quite as serious as previous broadcasts, but I thought it might be nice not to be too challenged as we attempt to relax into Christmas. I look forward to being with you all in 2026 and hope that you will have a very happy, healthy and peaceful Christmas and New Year.
This article is from the Caravan and Motorhome Club magazine from November 2025, and it is written by David Chapman. As many of us prepare for Christmas, I want to reflect on the words of one of our best-loved carols, The Holly and the Ivy. In it, we sing, "The holly bears the crown," which hints at our cultural attitudes towards these two plants. Although today we are familiar with a Victorian adaptation of the song, it has been around in different forms for several centuries, and the lyrics have changed markedly over time. An early related carol shows an even greater contrast in opinion towards each species. Holly stands in the hall, fair to behold. Ivy stands without the door, she is full, sore a cold. Holly hath birds, a fair full flock, the nightingale, the popinjay, the gentle lavrock. Good ivy, what birds hast thou? None but the owlet that cries, how, how. While it is true that holly has traditionally carried a certain prestige, its bright red berries being a sign of fertility, these lyrics misrepresent both the holly and the ivy. Yes, many birds do flock to feed on holly berries in the lead up to Christmas, but not the nightingale, popinjay, parrot, or lavrock, lark. And though the ivy might provide shelter for the odd tawny owl, it is inaccurate to say that it is otherwise devoid of bird life. Here are some hard facts. Ivy is not a parasite. It takes its own nutrients through its roots and generates energy using the chlorophyll in its leaves, using trees and structures simply for support. Ivy does not directly kill trees, though its weight and shading will have an impact on a tree's growth and might even bring down a dying tree. In fact, I consider ivy to be incredibly important to wildlife. Ivy berries ripen early in the year when hedgerows offer little in the way of food for birds. Wood pigeons can often be seen or heard crashing their way around the ivy-clad trees in their haste to eat as many berries as possible. Blackbirds, mistle thrushes, field fares and redwings all take their share too, as do small mammals including the nimble wood mouse. Throughout winter, ivy's dense evergreen foliage provides a safe haven in which birds can roost overnight. Some species, such as the tawny owl, will rest within it during the daytime. Many insects, including ladybirds, lacewings and brimstone butterflies, hibernate among the leaves or twisted branches of ivy plants sheltered against a tree or wall. The same leaves offer a vital food source to browsing animals, notably roe and red deer. The insects hiding in the ivy's leaves are a vital source of food for many of our smaller birds, such as goldcrests and wrens. Early in spring, before deciduous trees have developed their foliage, ivy offers a sanctuary for our resident birds, such as blackbirds, robins, dunnocks and song thrushes, which are looking for somewhere to nest. Later in the spring, they might be joined by summer migrants, including spotted flycatchers, which love to nestle in climbing plants. Ivy is a native species, and as such, our wildlife has evolved over many centuries to make use of it in some unnoticeable ways. Ivy does in fact have its own parasite, the ivy broomrape. This plant has no chlorophyll and therefore cannot exist without a host from which to draw energy. Several types of caterpillar feed on ivy leaves in the summer, including those of angleshades and swallow-tailed moths. One species of butterfly is also dependent upon ivy. The first generation of holly blue caterpillars feed on holly in the spring, but the second relies on ivy during the summer. This leaves me wondering why we call the holly blue when it could equally be the ivy blue. Maybe this is another example of our cultural bias. In late summer and autumn, ivy bears pollen and nectar at a time when most other flowering plants are waning. Look at a bank of ivy on a warm, sunny September day and you will witness a spectacle of life. Bumblebees, butterflies, wasps and hoverflies make a literal beeline for ivy flowers. And this bonanza is part of a food chain supporting other creatures. One particular insect worth a mention, because its association with ivy is reflected in its name, the ivy mining bee is active only in autumn when the ivy is in flower. The bee makes a burrow, or mine, in which to lay an egg. She then stalks the hole with the ivy pollen before filling it in and starting again. These are known as solitary bees because each female has its own hole, but huge colonies can occur on south-facing banks or in sandy soil. First recorded in the UK in 2001, the species is now widespread, and it's a fascinating insect to watch. So, while there will be times when we need to remove ivy from a specimen tree or maybe the wall of a house, we should make these decisions without the influence of prejudice or folklore. I would argue that wherever possible, we should give ivy and all its associated wildlife a chance.
From Jennifer Aldridge's Archer's Cookbook, published in 1994, we have a scene setting followed by two recipes. Copyright lies with Angela Piper. Where is Ambridge? There's no secret about it. Tucked into a fold in the undulating South Borsetshire countryside, it nestles in the Vale of the Am, just 6 miles out of Borchester. It's more than just a village with a pub and a church and a pond on the green. It's a special place, touched by a certain sort of magic. And in the village of Ambridge in 1994, St Stephen's church clock wheezes, pauses, and then strikes 7 times. A low mist hovers over the Am. Smoke hangs atop chimney stacks on crouching cottages. This is December, dunk and dreary. The cheery mainstays of Manorfield Close bear down on the village hall in greedy anticipation. Well, you tell me, Jean Harvey, where else can you get a slap-up three-course meal for £3.50 then? Them there fish and chips at Western on the trip was more than that, and half of them was cold. And Loxley Barrett's lot get the bus thrown in. The glossy doors swing open, and a wall of warmth greets them, along with the clattering of crockery and conversation. Rubber heels and ferrules squeak on waxed wooden floorboards, while Marjorie Antrobus's remarkably unrheumatic fingers give a jaunty rendition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Stout trestles and indescribable undergarments creak as ample bosoms and bottoms ease themselves into place. A curious haze of camphor and wintergreen wafts around Joe and his Sunday best corduroys. Steaming willow-patterned cups of tea are eagerly passed along the rows. There's a snapping of crackers and a cracking of jokes, and rather vulgar paper hats gluing themselves to glistening foreheads. Sid Perks struggles manfully into the moth-eaten garb of a steadily suffocating Father Christmas. That's right, you've guessed it. It's none other than the Ambridge and District Over 60s annual Christmas party. And here are the recipes for two of the puddings to be found there. Some grumble that this chocolate Yuletide log is not a conventional Christmas cake, but there's no fear of raisin seeds finding their way under Great Granny's dentures with this delicious, rich recipe. For the batter, you'll need 3 large-size eggs, 4 ounces or 100 grams of caster sugar, 3 ounces or 75 grams of plain flour, 1 ounce or 25 grams of cocoa, and 1 tablespoon of hot water. For the chocolate buttercream, you need 4 ounces or 100 grams of butter, 8 ounces or 225 grams of icing sugar, 4 ounces or 100 grams of plain dark chocolate, melted, and 2 tablespoons of strong black coffee. To make, grease and line a 12-by-9-inch Swiss roll tin, then whisk the eggs and sugar in a bowl with an electric hand whisk over a pan of hot water until pale and creamy. Sift in the flour and cocoa, folding in with a metal spoon, and then gently stir in the hot water. Pour the mixture into the prepared tin and bake in a preheated oven at 400 degrees Fahrenheit or 200 degrees centigrade or gas 6 for approximately 10 minutes, or until the cake feels springy when lightly pressed. Turn the cake out onto greaseproof paper and roll it up with a layer of well-sugared greaseproof paper inside. Allow to cool. To make the chocolate buttercream, beat the softened butter with the sifted icing sugar until fluffy. Then thoroughly stir in the melted chocolate and coffee. When the cake is cold, gently remove the paper and spread the cake with a little of the chocolate buttercream. Re-roll it and decorate with the remaining cream using a fork to make tree bark markings. Dust with icing sugar and decorate with a Christmas robin. Next, this ginger tipsy trifle has been tried and tested by this week's Mardler editor and comes highly recommended. The ingredients required for the base are one fatless ginger sponge, or a packet of fatless sponge cakes, then 1 pound of ginger marmalade or stem ginger preserve, a quarter of a bottle or 2 glasses of ginger wine, and a pint of rich custard cream, homemade as in following the recipe or ready-made. For the topping, you need a pint of double cream and then 2 ounces or 50 grams each of crystallized ginger and split blanched almonds to decorate. To make the fatless ginger sponge from scratch, follow the previous recipe of Yuletide log using 1 teaspoon of ground ginger instead of the chocolate, and bake either in 2 7-inch round tins or in a Swiss roll tin. Cool flat on a wire tray and cut into 1 inch or 2.5 centimetre fingers. Split the sponge fingers and sandwich with the ginger marmalade or preserve. Place at the bottom of a glass bowl and pour over the ginger wine. Cover with a layer of custard and chill. To make the topping, whip the cream until it stands in peaks and spread a thick layer over the custard. Decorate with split blanched almonds and crystallized ginger. And finally, in case you prefer to make your own rich custard cream, you will need 2 tablespoons of caster sugar, 20 fluid ounces or 1 pint or 600 mils of milk, half a vanilla pod and 4 medium-sized eggs. Put the sugar, milk, vanilla pods in a saucepan and slowly bring to the boil. Remove the vanilla pod and pour the milk over the beaten eggs, whisking briskly. Return this sauce to the pan and continue to cook over a low heat, stirring until the sauce thickens. Do not allow it to boil, otherwise it will curdle. We here in the Mardler studio hope that these recipes will give your festive season a touch of the Archer's nostalgia and bring some Ambridge over 60s party vibes your way. A very Merry Christmas to you all, and if Christmas is not your thing, then we wish you peace and joy and any reason you can think of to eat cake or pudding and celebrate. We look forward to joining you again next year.
As always, our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Our last few articles cover a new Channel 4 TV show, a call to postcards in a non-existent postbox, and some development plans in the Broads.
A new Channel 4 show, shot in North Norfolk and starring a celebrity chef, is due to be released next year. Cy King of the BBC's Hairy Bikers fame visited the North Norfolk Railway Station in Sheringham in August to film his new show called Top of the Stops. It will mark the chef's first solo project following the death of his co-star Dave Myers in 2024. In Top of the Stops, produced by Yeti Television, Cy King will explore some of the most eclectic offerings in the UK's network of more than 2,600 stations. The Hairy Biker will then meet the people who keep train stations ticking, from engineers who work behind the scenes to those who serve the passengers. Anna Davis, executive producer at Yeti Television, said, "There's something uniquely British about our love of railways, but usually it's the trains, not the stations, that get the limelight. There are so many amazing stories to be uncovered in stations, big and small, with unique characters who run them and incredible history. And Cy is the perfect person to be taking us on that journey." King will be joined by transport historian Siddy Holloway and architect Damien Burrows, who will teach the chef about why buildings and the structural feats they represent are so important. Top of the Stops will consist of 4 60-minute episodes. In August, the show stopped by to film the North Norfolk Railway in Sheringham. Running from Sheringham to Holt, the railway is also known as the Poppy Line because of the beautiful red flowers that bloom along the route from late spring to summer. It's part of the former Melton Constable to Cromer Beach Line of the Midland and Great Northern Joint Railway, which was built in 1893 and closed, despite protests, in 1959. Since 1975, it's been running as a preservation railway, which lets passengers hop aboard heritage locomotives. Though well-loved by locals, the Poppy Line has also recently been hailed on the national stage by being included in the Times Roundup of the country's 16 best heritage railways. Despite filming in Sheringham, King and his crew stayed at the Royal Hotel in Munsley, where he enjoyed eating Norfolk produce. Kenny Fotis, owner of the hotel, said, "He was an absolute pleasure and made all the staff smile. Cy is a true gentleman and seems to be a fan of North Norfolk. He said, we're very lucky to live in such a lovely local area. We've just had a refurb, so he came at the right time." It's unclear if the hairy biker will visit any more train stations in the county. Top of the Stops was originally due to begin airing weekly on November the 27th, but the show has since been postponed until the new year, according to the Strawberry Line Cafe in Yatton, North Somerset, another spot visited by King. An exact release date has yet to be confirmed.
Nicola Colchester, founder of the pub group Colchester Inns, has applied for planning permission to bring the former TSB bank in Aylsham back into use, but with a new purpose. The proposal would see the building be converted into a mixed-use facility with a retail unit and short-stay accommodation for the Black Boys, a hotel and restaurant owned by the pub group a few doors away. This includes 6 rooms to provide convenient and comfortable lodging to support the hotel and space on the ground floor for a local business to take on. A planning statement said, "The holistic objective of the proposal is to bring a prominent feature of Aylsham's High Street back into active use, contributing to the vitality of the town centre through a blend of commercial and visitor accommodation uses. The works include new partition walls in the Grade 2 listed building, alongside other internal alterations, as it was described as being in partial disrepair. The bank, which is in the marketplace, closed in May this year."
Richardson's Leisure has been granted permission to update its site at Stalham, which will include new visitor facilities and extra moorings. The firm says the scheme is part of a £2 million investment in its locations, with its site in Hemsby also due to benefit. Stalham is the company's main base on the Broads and is used by both its dayboat and cruiser hire options. The firm hopes to encourage more day visitors to the hub by adding a Broads National Park visitor centre to the mix, featuring an interactive learning and play experience with digital screens and immersive displays. It also plans to construct a Broads-themed outdoor adventure experience and outdoor classroom for visiting schools and clubs. At a recent meeting, Broads Authority members unanimously approved the scheme. However, there were some reservations about the potential harm caused by the removal of peat for the moorings. Matthew Shardlaw worried the scheme could set a precedent that might allow further large-scale peat removal projects. Peatlands are massive carbon sinks, and disturbing them can release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The removed peat is intended to be spread on farmland to help replenish the soil, but this will still create carbon emissions. However, an officer said there was no better solution, while other members said it is a question of balance, as the scheme will help boost the economy of the Norfolk Broads and provide jobs. Neighbours also worried about the increased traffic the revamp could bring, both on the River Ant and the roads. Ultimately, the scheme was approved unanimously, but strict conditions were imposed to ensure the peat issue is managed appropriately.
Villagers in Guestwick, between Aylsham and Fakenham, have been demanding answers from the Royal Mail since April, when their last remaining postbox was stolen by thieves, the second in as many years. A replacement box was promised by November, but repeated attempts to get an update have gone unanswered. To make matters worse, this month, every house in the village received a letter from the Royal Mail reminding people to pop their festive letters and parcels in a postbox. Judith Wood, a retiree living in the village, said the leaflet was maddening. It feels quite sad and ironic that the post office is urging us to use postboxes but not replacing our postbox, she said. Yes, we can use emails. Yes, we are moving away from paper, but it's that time of year when we like to send a card, and in our village we cannot. It's a massive inconvenience. Guestwick, a village of around 200 residents, once had two postboxes before they were both stolen in the space of 2 years. Villagers, many elderly and without a car, have now been forced to travel to other postboxes in neighbouring villages or make their way to Causton's post office 6 miles away. David Thomas, the Broadland councillor representing the area, said the lack of progress was now affecting everyday life. Royal Mail assured us the postbox would be replaced by mid-autumn, yet we are now well beyond that deadline with no communication. Villagers simply want the service they were promised restored. Guestwick's stolen postboxes mark a growing issue in the region. Over the summer, North Norfolk MP Steph Aquarone took up a similar case in Felbrigg near Cromer, where a village box has been stolen and not replaced. He brought the matter to Parliament, criticising Royal Mail for failing to restore vital services to rural communities. A Freedom of Information request to Norfolk Police revealed that more than 50 postboxes were stolen across the county between 2019 and 2024, an average of 10 thefts per year. Some can fetch thousands online, with rare double-cast iron pillar boxes selling for as much as £12,000. Royal Mail has been approached for comment.
And that brings us to the end of this festive edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer for her last time today was Julia Bloomfield, and we wish her a happy retirement from the Mardler. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box, who thanks you for listening and wishes you comfort and joy over the festive season.
Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health and an extra special whatever you wish for at this time of year. And we look forward to joining you again on the 9th of January. Don't forget, you get a special New Year magazine edition on the 2nd of January. But for now,
from the Mardo we sing to you and your kin. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We